I am delighted, as always, to be here and partake of your hospitality, which is more than I can say for my neighbors back in Eau Claire, where I'm staying at the moment. I arrived this morning, and His Excellency asked me how I was doing, and I informed him I had rabies. It was about a week ago I was taking my morning constitutional, which I do in order to remain in this remarkably fit shape that you see before me. And I was about five houses away from returning to my parents' home where I'm currently in residence. And the neighbor lady let up the garage door, and out came the hound of hell after me. For months as I walked by, he had been in the garage or in the window waiting to get a chance at me, barking and snarling, but there had always been a barrier of some kind. And when she let the garage door up, he was free. It was an Irish setter. Came and anchored his teeth in the back of my left thigh, which made it very difficult to even kick. A smart dog. And so I was there bleeding and cursing, and then in thinking about it, it came clear to me that it was an Irish setter, more orange than red, and hence obviously a Protestant dog, who somehow knew I was a Catholic and attacked me as a result, thus making it a hate crime. So. I bring up this ugly episode for two reasons. One, to point out that in this little tale we have an essential part of comedy, which I'm going to be talking about tonight. And number two, to talk about the nature of taming wild beasts, which is what the play is about. Now, as I told this story of my misfortunes, and it really was ugly. I mean, it's not nice to have a large dog's teeth anchored in the back of your leg and unable to dislodge it. And I have prominent holes in the back of my leg even now. The wounds are healing. But as I tell this story, most of you are laughing. I do not assume this means malice on your part or that you are on the side of the dog. But the fact of the matter is that we are at the core of one of the key aspects of comedy. Comedy at its most basic, comedy in terms of what we understand, is that which always reminds us we're human and keeps us, if you will, somehow humble in our humanity. We are creatures of flesh and blood for all of our pretensions. And whenever we are reminded that we are creatures of flesh and blood, flesh, which I'm reminded of all too often, and blood, when the dog gets a big chunk out of my leg and reveals what's running inside the body, or the most basic joke on earth, which is someone slipping on a banana peel and falling down. And again, the reaction has always been laughter from those who see it happen, in which someone who is pretending to be high and mighty is literally brought down to earth, reminded that he's subject to the laws of gravity, or in my case, reminded that for all my pomposity of taking a morning walk and thinking I'm safe in my own neighborhood, at any moment, nature red in tooth and claw can come at me and and remind me of my own helplessness. And that's funny. Anything that reminds us of our humanity has a kind of humor in it, because we often tend to be proud and pompous. And comedy will always, always bring us down to earth. The other thing it should remind us is a simple fact that in a state of nature, it's not easy to get along with the animals, much less with one another. We are meant to live together in groups for the most part. There are some very fine saints who were hermits, but that status tended to be unusual. Most of us are meant to live in groups. And living in groups is not easy. Anytime we live in communities of any kind, there are bound to be tensions. Comedy is also social in nature. And the core of comedy is always looking at the tensions and the problems that result from mankind trying to live together as a group. Comedy is social. Comedy is almost always social. And one reason that comedy is particularly delightful, and what comedy at its best does, is remind us that it is possible to live together. It is possible to compromise. It is possible to find an appropriate balance in which everyone can not only live comfortably, but well and in a well-ordered state. And hence the end of almost all comedy, all great comedy, because needless to say, many of the major tensions that exist in any society are those between men and women, and I'll get to that in a moment, because it is the subject of this play. Those tensions between men and women can be resolved. It is possible to leave the battlefield and find a perfect union, and that perfect union can be found in a good marriage. And that's why most great comedy ends in marriage. It is a representation of renewal, regeneration, a new beginning within a social order that is indeed sanctified. And comedy always ends and leaves us feeling, it ends in happiness and suggests future happiness because it is giving a vision of renewal, a new beginning, a new start. And that obviously, done magnificently, I think, in the Zeffirelli film, which I'll be referring back to, that wonderful sense of finally coming to a starting place. I'll come back to this later in the lecture, but, I was speaking with Father Dorn, and the way in which Zeffirelli adds something to the play that I think is absolutely splendid, those exchanged glances between Kate and Petruchio at the table when they're looking at the children playing. Nothing is said, but there is the clear sense that at that moment, there is a full acknowledgement of what marriage is about, why they were married, and what the future holds for them. And it's beautifully done by Zeffirelli. The film has lovely touches like that that are fully supportive of things in the play. It's what a good director will do. A good director will add and enrich what's already there. And there are many cases when the play does that. Point being, the play ends looking forward to this union and what that union will produce. And that is children, which is why marriage must also be the symbol of the future of any society. If a comedy looks at social tensions, the end of comedy through marriage looks forward to the renewal of society itself. Because there will be new people, and the society will be renewed. So, just two things, and keep these in mind because it's very much what I'm going to be talking about. And indeed, it's true of almost any comedy. Comedy is not jokes as such. We often think of it that way, but that's not what comedy is. Comedy is a reminder of our common humanity, the fact that we are flesh and blood, subject to laws of nature, subject and into higher laws, and that's part of what this play is about, subject to spiritual laws as well, that you cannot break, that you cannot violate. And when we are reminded of that fact, when we are reminded of our common humanity, of our physical nature, that we are physical creatures in a real world, laughter is released. Okay, it's a happy reminder. And secondly, comedy is a structuring of experience. Comedy is an ordering of events, moving from tension, problems, often chaos and disorder, toward a genuine vision of order that brings about renewal and the promise for a happy future. And that's why, at the end of any comedy, any good comedy, we should have that sense of renewal. Comedy ends with a vision of one of the theological virtues, which is hope. Comedy always should end with that sense of hope. And again, that comes out of the perfect image of the sacrament of marriage. Because marriage in itself, in the nature of the sacrament, is a sacrament that is filled with hope. It looks forward. It looks to a bright future. Now, back to that uncivilized dog. Let me talk for a moment about the title of the play. There is the fact that the word shrew, it would have been pronounced shrow in Shakespeare's day, which is why some of you reading it may have noticed some odd puns here. He often rhymes the word shrew with the word S-O. Reason being, would have pronounced shrow in his time, and S-O would have been Saul. And we get a close rhyme. It has come to mean an unruly woman. And that's what it had meant in Shakespeare's day. But it begins, of course, as an actual nasty little animal. This comes from a contemporary writer in Shakespeare's own time, Edward Topsell, who wrote A History of Four-Footed Beasts. And this is what he says about the shrew. It's very nice. And it gives you a sense of what Shakespeare's own contemporaries would have thought of the animal and what they meant in applying that word to a woman, to an unruly woman. It is a ravening beast, feigning itself to be gentle and tame, but being touched, it biteth deep and poisoneth deadly. It beareth a cruel mind, desiring to hurt anything. Neither is there any creature that it loveth, or it loveth him, because it is feared of all. The cats, as we have said, do hunt it and kill it, but they eat not them, for if they do, they consume away in time. That's a wonderful image. The creature is so nasty that even if a cat kills it and eats it, it will eventually kill the cat. the shrew was simply an ugly animal that had come to acquire devilish properties. And the word was often applied or connected with the devil himself. So that this is not a complimentary word to use about a woman. It is also the reason why, for those of you that have read the play, you'll notice the play is filled with animal imagery. And I'll look at some examples of that later on, but there is animal imagery everywhere. And when we're talking about taming in the title, that's exactly what's going on in the play. We have a wild creature of nature that must be broken, if you will, made obedient and tamed before the play can reach its proper conclusion, which is a happy and correct marriage. The play is very unusual in one sense, in that we get the wedding ceremony in the middle of the play, but of course, it's a mock wedding. It is not a real wedding, in that there is no joining of that couple. And that joining does not come until the end of the play. It's a very clever structuring device by Shakespeare, where he shows us the wedding, but because of the disorder in that society, the wedding itself becomes less than it should be, and we do not have the final joining of husband and wife until the very end of the play. The second wedding feast, the wedding feast for Lucentio and Bianca, that is celebrated, but it is at that wedding feast that it comes clear to us we now have a real marriage between Caterina and Petruchio. It is at that moment it becomes clear that that is now a real marriage in a fullness of the word. So that there must be that taming. The wild, unruly creature must be tamed. Now, let me put this in context because this play is an early play of Shakespeare's. As a result, he is learning his craft. He was a master early on, obviously. It's a great play. But it does not have all the full complexity that we find in some of the later comedies, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Much Ado About Nothing. It's an early play filled with energy. He's learning his business. But what we see is that in his broadest understanding, from the very beginning of his career, this artist's inspiration and imagination is filled with Catholic doctrine and Catholic principles. It is very interesting as he puts this play together, and a play probably written, we don't know for certain, somewhere between 1589 and 1594 is sort of the latest possible date. My guess is it falls somewhere in between those two dates. So early on in his career, he is taking already two very different plots and combining them. When you see the work, it's not evident because you don't really see the way in which he's joined them. But he's taken two plots from two very different comic traditions. The more literary of the two plots comes from Roman comedy, and it's what we simply call romantic comedy. Handsome young man meets beautiful young woman. There are obstacles to their union, and thanks usually to a clever servant or a clever slave, the older generation is outfoxed, and love triumphs in the end. This is called Roman comedy because it is the kind of comedy written by the two great Roman playwrights, Plautus and Terence. And they made it very popular, and it was a comedy of romance. It was very popular in Shakespeare's time. He perfected it, and he presents it in this play, in the Lucentio-Bianca plot. Lucentio comes to Padua, sees Bianca, falls in love with her, but he cannot have her because of a rule set down by her father, Baptista, who says the younger daughter cannot be married until the older daughter is married. Okay, and but through the clever devices of Tranio, Lucentio gets to meet Bianca, he gets to woo her, they fall in love, and eventually they are reconciled with the fathers. It's a subplot. It's the secondary plot. But Shakespeare is taking this plot and uniting it to another one. And he does it, of course, in The Two Daughters. Brilliantly done, very simply, but cleverly done. What we have in the Caterina Petruchio plot comes from the English comedy tradition in the theater, and interestingly enough, from the mystery plays. The mystery plays were those Bible plays out of which the English drama grew. They were done by the guilds. They were done in particular cities. And they told the stories from Scripture in play form. They were hugely popular, and they were usually presented on Corpus Christi Day. We know for a fact that young Master Shakespeare was aware of this tradition because the last cycle of mystery plays to be presented was presented in 1574 in Coventry, close to Stratford, where Shakespeare grew up. And insofar as we know that Shakespeare's father, John Shakespeare, was a devout Catholic, very religious man, on Corpus Christi they would have gone to Coventry and seen those plays. So it's, again, some people would call it simply a coincidence. I view it as providential, that the last time the English mystery plays were done in England were in Coventry, near Stratford, where this particular young man could go and witness them. So he had seen them. The comic tradition of the Battle of the Sexes comes out of the Noah play. It was something added. It's not scriptural. It's something added by playwrights to the Noah play, the most famous of them being the Wakefield Noah. The man, we don't know who he was. As with most great medieval art, it's anonymous. We don't know who the man was. We call him the Wakefield Master because he was a great playwright, whoever he was. He wrote a version of the Noah play in which Noah's wife has no intention of getting on the ark. Noah may very well have built the ark, may very well tell her that the family is under a command by God to get on that boat, tell her what's coming. She's having no part of it. She has no intention of going on the boat with him. And you get a wonderful disputation in the play between husband and wife that begins a tradition of the battle of the sexes in English drama that runs through Shakespeare, through Restoration comedy, into George Bernard Shaw, into Noel Coward, and finally lands in our own country with a very unpleasant play called Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by our own Edward Albee. This vision of the battling sexes, of man and woman turning on each other, going at each other, stretches all the way back in the English dramatic tradition to the Wakefield Noah. He finally gets her on the boat, by the way. She does, needless to say, end up going on the ark simply by wrestling her to the ground, brutalizing her, although she puts up a good fight as well. And It is pure old-fashioned physical comedy. As husband and wife battle each other, they're both quite elderly, and finally They're both so worn out that Noah has very little trouble just dragging her onto the ark. And she's so worn out, there's no fight left in her. It's a very funny play, a magnificent play. Well, Shakespeare would have known that, and out of that tradition, and it's a comic tradition of the Battle of the Sexes coming out of the English mystery play. Mystery play simply means Bible play, scriptural play. Out of that tradition that we get Caterina and Petruchio, okay? The battling couple. He transforms it. He does fascinating things with it. But the fact of the matter is that tradition didn't just start in the English mystery play. It's something that has been known about as long as there has been one man and one woman. It is indeed in Scripture. It's in the Greek drama. It doesn't matter where you turn. The fact of the matter is men and women are different creatures and often have great difficulty in getting along. Nevertheless, it is God's intention that they should live together as one. And this presents certain problems. And over the space of time, the best artists have analyzed these problems. It is very curious to me that in our own age, when science has shown us through biology, particularly chemistry, that we are dealing really with two very different creatures in terms of not just the biological composition, but the very chemistry of what makes these bodies operate. When we know, and it's something that science does well, through the explorations of science, that there are real differences in the way in which these creatures were created, we should pretend they're the same. Absolutely ridiculous, but it's part of the schizophrenian craziness of the age in which we live. What is the nature of that difference? The difference is not just chemical, although that's part of it. I would make the claim that the differences between man and woman are differences of biology, obviously, differences that are social, obviously, and differences that are spiritual. On almost every sphere, we have two different creatures here. How do we define it? Why should there be a problem? And where does this problem come from? Well, science may tell us one thing, but let's go further back and find someone who knew these differences very well and gave expression to it in a profound manner with great truth. And I'll quote a woman here. Okay, so I'm an old bachelor daring to talk about these things to a room full of men. Okay, at this point, if this tape gets out at this point and there's a woman listening to it, she's seething. Okay, she's seething. So let's be fair here, and I will discuss the most basic difference between the male and female by quoting a woman. Let me quote Mother Goose. Source of great wisdom. I am going back to one of the oldest Mother Goose rhymes. Okay? You may want to write this down. This is a classic. You can use it for the rest of your lives. Okay? I'll say it once and then I'll go through it slowly so you can get it down. The heart, he loves the high wood. The hair, she loves the hill. The knight, he loves his bright sword. The lady loves her will. Smart cookie, Mother Goose. It's all right there in those four little lines. Let me take it apart and see what she's talking about and why she knew what she was talking about. The first two lines refer to two animals, a heart and a hare. The heart being, of course, a male deer, okay? The heart, he loves the high wood. You've got to have an image of one of those magnificent bucks. You probably see them around here. They wander the countryside with the remarkable set of antlers who is climbing upward, okay? Who is climbing upward, going into the wood. The male loves to take on adventure, okay? Go upward, go higher. Not just the wood, the high wood. Okay? The male goes out for adventure, challenge, has to prove himself. And the high wood, solitude, getting away from family, home, responsibility, none of it. No, I'm going to the woods. I'm going to the high woods. If you want to see me, you can find me there. I'll come back when I'm good and ready. I'm going bowling with my friends, okay? It is the same impulse. It's to break away, to get away, solitude, adventure, okay? I can bowl a 300 game, okay? The sense of a challenge. The heart, he loves the high wood. The hare, she loves the hill. By contrast, gentleness, vantage point from which you can see everything. The female hare has to know what's going on and is quite willing to be public and a bit exposed by being up on the hill and seeing what everybody else is doing. And of course, the hare is a female rabbit, and we're talking fertility, okay? As opposed to the male deer that climbs upward and hides out in the wood, we've got the female rabbit that's got a good vantage point, and undoubtedly for some, you know, connected with the fact of being able to do what rabbits always do, produce young, and lots of them, okay? The hart, he loves the high wood. The hare, she loves the hill. The knight, he loves his bright sword. Now, it's a variation on the deer, but now we get the man, the knight, in shining armor, who is going to go out and fight, who is going to, and this is hugely important, because it is implied in that line of poetry, the man is going out to do what good men do, and that is defend that which is right and just. Okay? The knight has his sword and is going forward to establish, maintain moral order. It is the job of the male. But at the same time, he loves his bright sword. Okay? If he's going out to do this, then he wants a big weapon, the best weapon, the shiniest weapon, and it's got to be his. Okay? And it's not just a matter of we're all banding together now and we'll do this together. It is that male competitiveness that says, I'll do it better. I'm the best. And in that line of poetry, we get the nightmare of the male ego, okay? The male ego, the man needing to stand out, be important, be the best, have the shiniest sword, have the biggest sword, have the bloodiest sword, okay? Take on the biggest action, okay? That which is a component of manliness, therefore hugely important and necessary, but must be controlled. Because out of control, you're going to get a Tamburlaine, a Genghis Khan. You're going to get some sort of overpowering monster that's out of control. The knight, he loves his bright sword. The lady loves her will. There's a wonderful moment. I've never done Chaucer here. I'll have to come do Chaucer sometime. One of the Canterbury Tales, the Wife of Bath's Tale, in which the little tale that she tells as they ride to Canterbury, a young man is sent out in the world, and he has to discover a question. He has to find the answer to a question. The question is, what do women want? It's reported in our own time that Dr. Freud himself, in desperation one day, uttered those words. What do women want? Well, if he'd read his Chaucer, he would have known. Because in The Wife of Bath's Tale, the young man finds out that what the woman wants is her will. She wants what she wants. It has nothing to do with the external object. It has to do with validation of getting what she wants. Okay? I'll take an example close to home. And my brother married a lovely French woman. Lovely French woman. She's a good wife. She's a good mother. When they were courting, and to this day, There is a source of tension in the marriage. I'm making this public. When they go out to eat, and she looks at the menu, my brother will say, "Now you see anything you want? Oh yeah, I think this sounds good. No, you're sure you want that? Oh, that sounds good. That's it. You don't want anything? No, that's." She will order. He will order something. The dinners will come, and she will say, looking at his dinner, "Oh, that looks good. Oh, that looks really. Could I have a little taste of that? Oh, that's just wonderful." Then she'll try her own dinner and say, "It's really not good." And eventually. So he began trying to outfox her by saying, "You know, well, what do you want to order? It looks good." And she'll say, "Well, I think I want to order this." And he will then order, okay? He will then order something that he doesn't really want, but he thinks he can pass off on her. Never, it absolutely never works. It absolutely never works. There may be two or three exchanges of the plate, and she'll end up eating what he got her to order because he thought he'd get it. And somehow she ends up back with it. It's just, now, the point being, this has nothing to do with the food. This has nothing whatsoever to do with the food. It has to do with the assertion of the female will. The woman simply determined that she will have her way and see anything through to what she is determined it will be. There is an obvious reason for this, and it is a complaint, gentlemen, that women make against us, that we cannot say nay. And that is, try going through childbirth. We will never have to do it. We will never have to do it. Our mothers, God bless them, did it. But the fact of the matter is, God gave woman the female will, because without that will, we wouldn't be here. To set one's mind on carrying that child for 9 months and giving birth to it and then raising that child demands a strong will. And when that will is in line with God's will, you have a happy, healthy family. When that will, as has happened in our own time, begins to be corrupted or perverted, or when there is not a male to clash with that will and allows that will its way, you end up with the woman who wills the destruction of her own children. And that is a horrifying thing. We're not here to talk about that tonight. We're here to talk about comedy. But the fact of the matter is, the female will, for good or bad, is to a large degree what drives the woman. She will have what she wants. She will get it. And what we have in these two characters, Shakespeare draws them at the beginning of his career. He draws them in bold strokes, but there they are. I don't know if he knew the Mother Goose rhyme or not, but there they are. Petruchio, at the beginning of the play, is all ego. Caterina at the beginning of the play is all will. And they clash, and it is a mighty battle. Now, I want to go to the play and look at this and see how it's presented, because this is where we are. This is what's happening. This is what's happening in the play. Before I do that, a couple of quick words. It's not in the film. Those of you who are reading the play will find this. The play has a two-scene induction, a little prologue. A fascinating and curious little introductory section. It was common in the plays of Shakespeare's time. He's using it very interestingly here. I don't want to take much time on it, but for those of you who are reading the play, just a little clue as to what's going on. Christopher Sly is a tinker, a workman, who is thrown out of a tavern where it was warm and comfortable and there was good drink. We might say paradise for a tinker. The hostess has had enough. He's not paying. He's not following the rules. He's not doing what he's supposed to. And he is thrown out. Boom! Gate shut against him. And then a nobleman comes along who's out hunting, finds him passed out drunk. They decide to play a trick on him. They dress him up as a lord, take him to the nobleman's castle, and tell him he is wealthy, a gentleman, and try to convince him that he is something other than what he is. And Sly suddenly has no clue as to who he is, where he is, what's happening. Is he really just a tinker as he thought, or has he suddenly become Lord Christopher Sly? And then they put on a play for him, and the play is Taming of the Shrew. Now, the induction doesn't come back at the end of the play. What is a little make-believe game as the play begins, by the end has become something real, and we never see Christopher Sly again. But what the little induction is all about is, first and foremost, we have lost that good, warm, comfortable, happy place where we could have lived quite contentedly. We've been thrown out. The gate is closed to us. We may get ourselves all dressed up and think that we're high and mighty, and know not that we are poor and low and helpless. This is a man who does not know who he is. And the world around him will lie to him and not tell him who he is. And we are heading into a comedy where hardly any of the characters have any understanding of who they are. I'll go through a list for you in a moment, but you can start making the list in your own head of the number of characters in this play who become someone else, disguise themselves as someone else, or are not behaving according to the proper role that they have been given. It's almost the entire cast list. We get that set up in the little induction. That's what the little induction is. An induction is always giving us a little clue as to how we can look at the play. And in the induction, we have a man who does not know who he is because those around him are playing games with him and for their own amusement, not letting him know his real self. In one sense, we're at the core, the golden words from Socrates, know thyself. And the fact of the matter is, that's very hard to do. And in this play, it's exceptionally hard to do because we have a society that is not functioning properly. Now, let's start at the very beginning, look at an example of this. Act 1, Scene 1, those of you that have your texts. We begin with the subplot. Lucentio comes in with his servant Tranio. They have traveled from Lombardy. They're coming to Padua. Why Padua? Because Padua was at that time the great university town. That was the center of learning. And please notice that this play that in one sense is about finding out who you are, learning what your proper role is and how you fit into society, begins with ideas of education. Education is very important at the beginning of this play. What is the point of education? The point of education is to discover who you are, to learn something about yourself and how you connect with that objective world that's out there. Thank you very much. Tranio, since for the great desire I had to see fair Padua, nursery of arts, I'm arrived for fruitful Lombardy, the pleasant garden of great Italy, and by my father's love and leave am armed with his good will and thy good company, my trusty servant, well approved in all. Here let us breathe and happily institute a course of learning and ingenious studies. Lucentio enters the play saying, I am a student. How long does it last? Until he sees Bianca. A matter of some minutes, perhaps. Okay? He is thinking of himself as a student. He is not a student. He is about to fall in love instantly. But something else is going on. I'm in the same speech. Line about 15. Hi, Vincentio's son, it shall become to serve all hopes conceived to deck his fortune with his virtuous deeds. I'm going to study, and then I'm going to go out and be a man of action and perform virtuous deeds. He does none of this. None of this. And therefore, Tranio, for the time I study virtue, and that part of philosophy will I apply that treats of happiness by virtue specially to be achieved. I will study virtue, I will learn virtue, I will live virtue, I will act virtuously, and therefore come to know happiness. Now, this makes sense, because virtue means, quite literally, manliness. Manliness. V-I-R, same root as virile, that which makes one manly. We're going to discover that in the play, but of course, Bianca crosses his path, and it becomes all butterflies and songs and sonnets and bam, it's all gone. And he is not manly from that point onward. Now, Tranio at least has a better sense of what's going on here and what's likely and says, well, don't just read your Aristotle, read your Ovid too, okay? Practice rhetoric in your common talk, music and poesy used to quicken you. The mathematics and the metaphysics fall to them as you find your stomach serves you. Follow your appetites. If you're hungry for mathematics, that's good. But let it be your stomach that leads you there. No profit grows where is no pleasure taken. And right away, we've got the tension between book learning and what we should do and our appetites. And the servant is saying, follow your appetites, because appetites are important. And he will prove during the play he believes that. Okay? The master, who is saying, no, I'm going to study virtue and be a student, doesn't last at all. And therefore, please notice, within the matter of minutes, the servant becomes the master. We have the little change, okay? And Tranio pretends to be Lucentio so that he can go into Baptista's house and say, I have brought someone who will teach, a school teacher. The pupil suddenly pretends to be a teacher. He can't teach. He doesn't know anything. He came there to learn. Now suddenly he's pretending to be a teacher. The teacher is not a teacher because the student never became a student. The master is now being a servant because the servant has become the master. This is just in the beginning. Nothing is operating the way it is supposed to. There is no order, and this is just the subplot. We're just starting the subplot. We could go into that at length. I don't have time. Let's move into Baptista's house. And what do we have there? We have a father who is not a good father. We could say that basically, if there is one thing a father must do, it is manage his children and run a good household. He's not doing it. It's very clear who's in charge in Baptista's house. It's his eldest daughter, Caterina. And they're all living in fear of this woman. She's a legend throughout the town. She is such a monster. She is so out of control, not just in her home, but I mean, she is a legend throughout the whole city. We hear of her long before we see her. Others are talking about her long before we see her. And the fact of the matter is, we move in. Baptista welcomes the young suitors, who of course are after Bianca's hand. Nobody wants Caterina. Or I might put it this way. None of them is man enough to take on Caterina. Okay? And if you remember those suitors, they're marvelously cast in the Zeffirelli film. It's just Hortensio, who is merely an idiot, a foppish idiot, and Gremio, who's an old man and has no business wooing anybody. So that at the beginning of the play, again, we have two suitors who are wooing a beautiful young woman, neither of whom has any business wooing any woman. One because he's effeminate, and the other because he's too old. We have more disorder. We have more disorder, okay? They show up, Baptista says, look, you know the arrangement. I will not marry her off until there's a husband for the eldest one. And Caterina says, I pray you, sir, is it your will to make a stale of me among these mates? It's one of the first times we hear her voice, and she is absolutely right. She's talking back to her father. That's not proper. But she's telling a truth. And from the beginning, we see there is a reason for this anger. There are no men around. She's controlling her father, and the suitors who are showing up are hardly suitors, would not make a good match. Young Lucentio comes and he becomes gaga over Bianca. He's, you know, the only slightly masculine one, and simply because at least he's going for what he wants in some sense and arranging things, is Tranio, but he's a servant. And the servants shouldn't be running things. It's a sign of severe disorder. Continues all the way through. Then Baptista says, no, but I will have schoolmasters to my youngest daughter. For I know she taketh most delight in music, instruments, and poetry. Schoolmasters will I keep within my house, fit to instruct her youth. not going to bother teaching the elder. He dismisses her. But, okay, we'll teach the younger. There is, and suddenly we see something that is quite true, and it's something the parent must never do. Play obvious favorites. Now, admittedly, Katerina is the difficult daughter. She's running the household, but we have the father playing obvious favorites here. And indeed, this continues well into Act 2, where Katerina again turns on Baptista. I'm in Act 2, Scene 1, line about 30. Katerina to her father, "What will you not suffer me? Nay, now I see she is your treasure. She must have a husband. I must dance barefoot on her wedding day, and for your love to her, lead apes in hell." The vision was old maids who didn't marry went to hell and had to lead apes down into hell. Not a pretty picture, okay? But there is, again, please notice, Katerina telling the truth. You have a favorite. I see she's your favorite. You only care about finding her a good husband. You don't care about me. Sadly true. There is total disorder in the house. He is not the father that he should be. There are no men until Petruchio shows up, and then we get a man with all his flaws. A man, but man at his worst. As she is the worst possible example of what a woman could be, sheer unrestrained will backed up by force, we now get Petruchio, who is the male ego without restraint. Okay? I'm in Act 1, Scene 2. He has arrived. I'm at line about 65. His father has died. He's going out in the world to find his fortune. "Signor Hortensio, twixt such friends as we, few words suffice." Again, it's the guy. It's the Hemingway hero. It's the man of few words. Blunt, direct, to the point. Okay? It's not Lucentio, who's just, you know, gibbering on about his love. We don't have that. We have a real man here. But I'll make it short. I'll cut to the chase. Here's the way it is. Okay, I love it. "Twixt such friends as we, few words suffice. And therefore, if thou know one rich enough to be Petruchio's wife, as wealth is the burden of my wooing dance, be she as foul as Florentius' love, as old as Sibyl, and as cursed and shrewd as Socrates' Xantippe, or worse, she moves me not, or not removes at least affections that in me, were she as rough as are the swelling Adriatic seas, I come to wive it wealthily in Padua. If wealthily, then happily in Padua." The man's a pig! An absolute pig! Marriage is only a financial arrangement, and it is going to be a financial arrangement to his advantage, and he'll marry anything. Absolutely anything, as long as there's a whole lot of money. It's just incredible. Grumio, the doddering old fool, picks it up and says, "Why, nothing comes amiss, so money comes with all." And we have, backed up by this decrepit old fool who's agreeing with Petruchio and basically saying, yeah, marry anything as long as you can put up with it, as long as you're rich. This is appalling. Shakespeare knew it was appalling. This is man at his worst. This is not someone ready for marriage. This is not a man who needs a wife. This is a man who needs an accountant. And that has nothing to do with the union between man and woman. My point being, Katerina, pure will. Petruchio, pure ego. But at least we have a real man and a real woman. Now, Petruchio is ready to take this woman on. We know the reason. The reason is money. Gremio tries to discourage him. I love the line, "Oh, sir, such a life with such a wife were strange." That's a wonderful line. But if you have a stomach, to it a God's name. Please notice the use of the word stomach again. Not accidental. The same word, tranio.